In the matter of Regina Little versus Kia Motors America Incorporated, can we please have appearances of counsel? Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Rivera-Soto.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, good afternoon. Before we start, if I may reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Chief Justice?
Yes.
Thank you. The issue before this court is both very limited and extremely broad. It is how this court is to ascertain damages in a breach of warranty case in a class action context. In that respect, in this case, there are really six areas that the court needs to address. First, whether in this case, which involves the breach of a warrant, alleged breach of a warranty in respect to an automobile, whether under Thiedemann, can a defendant be held liable for a breach of warranty where there are no damages that in fact were incurred. Second, whether under MUSE, and I think that's the correct pronunciation, M-U-I-S-E, 2, the second opinion from the Appellate Division from 2004, whether MUSE interdicts the Appellate Division's decision by approving bifurcated liability and damages proceedings. Third, and this issue arises only because the Appellate Division substantially relied on it, is whether the Tyson Foods decision applies here. Fourth, again because the Appellate Division raised it, does the Samuel Bassett versus Kia decision apply here? Fifth, was the class properly decertified as to damages? And sixth, the issue that the court identified in its order for certification, which was what alternate methods can be used by which damages may be fairly and practically determined in this action, taking into consideration the number of claimants and the difficulties some claimants may encounter in documenting their expenditures to repair their brakes. Let me start out with a warning. This case is not a safety issue case. Safety has never been at issue here. This is a wear case. The question is, did these brakes wear more often than they should have and therefore give rise to a breach of warranty claim? Nowhere in this record, is there any claim whatsoever that anyone was put at risk as a result of it. Now, in order to place this case into its proper context, it is important that a robust review of the facts be engaged in. And in this, I'm going to hearken back to Bleak House. This case was originally filed in 2001. Yes, 2001. I said that to someone earlier today, and they said, well, you must mean 2011. No, 2001. In 2003, during reconsideration of a class action certification motion, this is what plaintiff's counsel represented to the court, and I quote, "So, I think that the trial that will occur here will basically result in either a judgment in Kia's favor that there is no design defect, or a judgment in our favor that there is a design defect, that it has affected all of the cars, and that to the extent that there are individual damages, we can have claim forms to submit on this. Everybody has different damages. So what happens in this action is that to the extent that people in their cars in three times for repair or four times for repair will determine if we win after that what their individual damages are on a claims procedure." That statement was prophetic. Because what happened here is the case went to trial in 2008. And it went to trial on class certification as to both liability and damages. The jury rendered a rather interesting verdict. What it went to trial on was either breach of warranty, either under the common law or under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, and under the Consumer Fraud Act. The jury found in Kia's favor on the Consumer Fraud Act claim. On the damages that were alleged in respect of the breach of warranty, there were two sets of damages, diminution in value and out-of-pocket expenses. The jury determined that diminution in value was zero. That is straight out on the jury verdict form that the court can find at PA 10 and 11. So what happened as a result? If there was a glue that was holding the class together for purposes of damages, it was either the Consumer Fraud Act claim or the diminution in value claim. Because that was the only, those were the only claims that were common to the class. The moment those came off the table, you had a problem with the class because the class no longer had common issues, and common issues no longer predominated. So a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict was filed, and the trial judge, who by the way was the judge who sat through the 5-week trial, said, you know, I made a mistake. This case should not have gone to trial on damages on a class basis. So I'm decertifying the class. This is what she held, and I quote, individual issues of proof exist, including whether individual owners had to pay for brake repairs, which should have been covered by the warranty, whether individual owners had to pay for brake repairs more often than every 20,000 miles, or whether the replacement of the brakes was due to a cause other than the design, i.e., an accident. To rule otherwise would provide a windfall to those owners who did not actually pay for repairs more often than every 20,000 miles. The court further says, and I quote, the court has determined that individual issues do predominate. She went further and said, the effect of the decertification of the damages aspect of this case leaves the owners to prove whether they suffered damages.
Counsel, your position is the repair expenses should not have gone to the jury.
It is our position that the repair expenses could not go to the jury on a class basis.
And if they did go with the diminution still in, did the diminution evidence taint the any value in the repair?
It might have. I hesitate to speculate in respect of that, because the diminution in value under the UCC has to be determined at the time of the purchase. So in other words, did what you buy, was that what you thought you were going to get? Mm-hmm. What you actually purchased. The jury found that there was no diminution in value, even though it found a breach of warranty, which is honestly quite consistent, because you don't get a warranty claim until after you have item.
But at the charge conference, your predecessor said this should either go under a diminution or it should go under the repair, one or the other. That seems to have been perhaps a sensible suggestion, but the question now is, given what alternatives the jury had, is whether or not they chose one form of damages over the other, and whether it's possible for us to unravel that at this particular point, particularly given the fact that some may argue that the 750 is almost like an alter ego of diminution of value.
But it can't be the alter ego, right? Because the jury said no diminution in value. So it cannot be. And what I can say as a general proposition is there are a lot of things that were argued below that someone should have paid more attention to, and it wasn't. We have the record the way that we have it. But the fact of the matter is that the trial judge who sat through the trial, sat through the charge conference, said in her JNOV letter opinion, I made a mistake.
Is it your view that the two damage theories are not interconnected in any way?
They can't be, because one speaks to what an individual plaintiff has. That's my warranty claim, which may be different from yours and from his and from hers. Because if I only took the car in for repair once, and it was paid for under my warranty, I have no damages.
It was actually plaintiff's theory that they were separate and independent of one another, wasn't it?
That was their position.
They said that even if the repairs are made consistently and constantly, it remains a defective car, and its resale value is destroyed. So they were obviously with two theories before the jury. They were going with complete independence of those two theories.
And that both could exist at the same time. The problem that they have is once they lost the diminution in value theory, they lost the glue that held the class together.
So one of the arguments in the brief, and I'd like you to respond to it, is after you cut away the warrant, the 36,000-mile warranty, they're claiming that the fix could never be a cure. This is what they're arguing in their supplemental brief. It could never be a cure. So regardless of a new brake, you'd need another brake after that, another brake after that. And they're arguing, even putting aside the warranty, that the 750, three brakes, is not an unreasonable or absurd number. What are you?
And the answer to that is that's just diminution in value with another name. Because what they are arguing there, if you strip away the rhetoric, is that the warranty is evergreen.
What about the implied warranty? We have express warranty claims here, as I understand it, the jury found in favor of the plaintiffs on. And then we have the implied warranty of merchantability.
Correct.
And tell me if I'm wrong. I thought that the implied warranty of merchantability does not have temporal limitations on it.
The implied warranty of merchantability does not have temporal limitations. But the problem that you have is if you read the JNOV opinion by Judge Dupuis, when she talks about the errors in charge, she talks about the errors in charging the implied warranty. That what should have been charged in this case was express warranty, either under the common law or under the Magnuson-Moss Act. That was what was at issue, because anything other than that falls under the rubric of diminution in value, which the jury took off the table. So when you look at it, all we really have left here that's before this court is express warranty, either by operation of law or under the Magnuson-Moss Act. And in those circumstances, it is painfully clear that you cannot treat these people as if they were a unified whole, because they are not. The proofs in this case tell us that.
So where are we procedurally on that issue? Because you're highlighting what could be an important point. I'm sure both sides will have very important points on all sides. Where is that procedurally? She did charge implied warranty of merchantability. I don't know if there was an objection or not by your side. There was. Okay, over their objection. They came back with a verdict on that. She includes that as part of her JNOV in throwing the entire verdict out. Where are we in terms of the appeal of that determination? Is that before the court?
No, the only issue that is before this court, according to the order of certification, is the determination of damages and whether there are alternate means to determine damages by which this court can then give guidance to the courts below and what they can do.
Did the appellate division rule on that implied warranty?
No, they did not.
I didn't think it was anywhere there.
No, there are a lot of shortcomings to the appellate division decision, not the least of which is that they applied the wrong standard of review.
You want us to affirm Judge Bissell's findings with respect to the individual claim forms?
Yes, and the reason I say that, Justice Alvin, is that We spent, and when I say we, I mean everybody, spent a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money to get this before Judge Bissell. This was the claim process. Once a claims process was defined, 8,400 plus notices went out to every putative member of the class. And it was a claim form. And the claim form...
It was limited to 36,000 miles.
3 years, 36,000 miles.
So why should it have been limited to that? If the plaintiffs are right, and I want you to respond, that there was no cure, and therefore the brake problem would have gone beyond 36,000 miles to 72,000 to 100,000, why should it have been limited to 36?
Because the basis of their bargain was 3 years, 36,000 miles. That was the warranty.
On the express warranty.
On the express
but
warranty.
But this is why I'm focused on the implied warranty. Mm-hmm. If the trial court did not properly throw out the verdict on implied warranty in the JNOV, which the appellate division never reached, then the claim form should have taken into account the implied warranty, should it not?
Well, what the claim form did was that it said, and this is also something that unfortunately has way too much mystery in here when it should not, the claim form is pretty straightforward. It's a one-page form, and it specifically says, tell us your name, tell us the car that you bought. If you have the VIN number, that's a lot of help. Tell us which repairs you had to have. But then importantly, it said, even if you don't have any documentation, send in the form.
But wasn't all that limited to 36,000 miles?
Well, in its analysis, yes, but it was not for purposes of submission of a claim.
I see. So you're saying that later claims would have been sent in or at least asserted.
Well, perfect example is the representative plaintiff. The representative plaintiff here submitted a claim form that was actually submitted and signed for by her counsel that had 7 alleged repairs on it. The special master looked at it and said, during the warranty period, you had 3 claims. They were all covered by the warranty. You therefore have no damages. So we have a representative plaintiff,
okay,
which
so
is a different issue altogether, who doesn't represent the class.
So let's take that plaintiff as a single plaintiff. Why aren't those additional 4 repairs covered by the implied warranty of merchantability claim?
Because that portion of the verdict is no longer in play. That portion of the verdict, in our view, was vacated when the judge entered the judgment NOV.
Well, the whole verdict was vacated.
Not entirely. The damages verdict was vacated. And it was made clear that this is the procedure that is to be followed.
But the implied warranty was, the jury found implied warranty, and this is what Justice Patterson is saying. And she's suggesting, I think, that there's no temporal limitation to the implied warranty. So if there was a defect in the car and it went beyond the period covered by the warranty, the manufacturer is still responsible.
But if there had been a defect in the car that triggered the implied warranty of merchantability, then you couldn't have a zero diminution in value verdict. And you had a zero diminution in value verdict.
So
the two can't live together.
So that may be correct, but then the question arises whether or not the jury, given 2 different forms of damages, may have been affected by the one that you're saying should never have gone to them in the first place.
But you see, that's what plaintiffs argued, that both should go. They have to live with the consequences of that chaos, not us.
Well, they argued that both were independent and should, and
well,
and they were not mutually related.
That's what they argued, but the fact of the matter is you can't divorce the two. You can't say, I have a breach of the warranty, of the implied warranty of merchantability, but there's no diminution in value. One or the other has to be. And so, we have a jury verdict that says no diminution in value.
Unless the diminution, no cause, is based on the inability to come up to provide a number rather than the claim did not exist.
Well, that's an interesting...
It could have been, not liability, but a damage is no cause.
That's an interesting point, Justice Fernandez-Vina, because that highlights really what's at the core of this appeal. Here you have a claim that was being presented pursuant to expert testimony. Mr. King testified that he created a model plaintiff that the one single representative plaintiff in this case did not meet his model. And based on that, he came up with this theory that there should have been 5 additional repairs over a 100,000-mile period that should have been at $250 a piece, and therefore each plaintiff should have been entitled to $1,250. That was his theory. But he conceded, because he had no choice, and find the actual language. He conceded, question, does your opinion apply to Mrs. Little, the named class representative? Answer, clearly you have to have out-of-pocket expenses. So I would say probably not. Question, is it probably not or no, sir? Answer, I would say no. That's at Supplemental Appendix, page 19.
Now, this is a breach of warranty case. This is not a pricing case. This is not a product liability case. This is not a negligence case. This is, it's not a donning and doffing case, as you, I'm sure, we're about to argue to us with respect
when
to
when I get to Tyson Foods, we'll talk about
Tyson
donning
Foods.
And doffing.
But this is a breach of warranty.
Yes.
So what are the measure, what are the alternative measures of damages for a breach of warranty?
Did you get what the warranty said you were going to get?
Diminution in value.
No, not diminution in value. The warrant didn't say that. The warranty said we will repair.
Okay. So that's cost of repair.
Cost of repair.
Okay. But the restatement allows diminution in value as a measure of damages in a warranty case, breach of warranty case.
Well,
is that correct?
I'm not sure that I would agree with that. I don't think that the restatement goes that far. But certainly, even if it does, it is not in play in this case because we have a jury verdict that says no diminution in value.
Is cost of repair, provided there is a cure, your adversary, at least in the supplemental brief, is saying there could be no cure because the nature of the system would always lead to a wear of 10,000 miles or less. Go ahead.
They can argue that till the cows come home. The fact of the matter is that it is a warranty case. So the warranty defines the extent of the manufacturer's liability because that's the basis of the bargain between the consumer and the manufacturer. If they wanted something different, they could either negotiate something different or buy a different product. But when they bought this product, they bought it based upon an express warranty that said 3 years, 36,000 miles. Everybody who bought a car bought it under those circumstances. And it is a repair warranty. It's not a fix warranty. It's not a cure warranty. Because cure is no different than changing the value of the car.
But if you
have can't conflate the two.
But if you have to constantly replace the brake pads, doesn't that indicate that the, and I'm looking at the charge to the jury, in a breach of warranty case, one measure of damages is the difference at the time of delivery between the value of the vehicle as accepted and the value of the vehicle as it would have been if it was as it was warranted. And the implied warranty would be that I would think these brake pads will wear the way most brake pads wear in a normal course, no?
And if they don't, wear according to that normal course schedule, then We will repair them as long as they are within the warranty period. It's not an evergreen warranty.
Well, the implied warranty is a merchantability. That's mm-hmm. And what does merchantability mean in this situation?
Under these circumstances is, did you get what you paid for? And what you got was, you got a car subject to a warranty. If there is a defect in that car, then technically you should be able to get the difference in value between what you thought you were buying and what you in fact did buy. Except that here the jury's determined there is no difference in value because there's no diminution in value.
But isn't there a question still about whether or not a buyer would have expected to get a brake system that caused so much heat that you would have repairs as frequently as these cars seem to have had demonstrated through your own records?
Well, that's an interesting point because the records are not as conclusive as folks would have it. There were, at trial, only one person testified on behalf of the plaintiff to talk about the wear of their brakes, and that was the plaintiff herself. She testified that she had five different instances where she had to replace her brakes. Kia presented the testimony of at least two other owners who said, I've driven it for 75,000 miles. I haven't had to replace my brakes. So which one isn't?
But I thought you put in evidence that indicated that the entire system had to change, which is why it did in 2001. And all you could do for the cars in these model years was to simply replace the pads and rotors as they wore out from the heat.
Which we did more generously than the warranty allowed for at least the warranty period.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's the fear of no good deed going unpunished. When people started to complain, Kia reacted.
Well, you did more than do that. You also gave coupons out, and you did other free repairs through your
Absolutely.
Goodwill service.
And by the way, those repairs were not, they were free to the customer. They were not free to Kia.
Mm-hmm.
The dealers would charge Kia, and Kia would pay. And as we pointed out in our brief, there were at least $1.4 million worth of repairs that mm-hmm. were done totally gratuitously.
Mm-hmm.
On Kia's part. So it's not like we left all these people out there in the rain. Kia recognized that there was a problem, and it said, we need to do our best to try to fix this. But it certainly is not to provide a windfall for members of this class who had no damages, or even worse, who actually had claims, brought it in for warranty, was fixed under the warranty that Kia then paid for, and now Kia has to pay them a second time for it.
Step back from the facts of this case for just a moment and tell us as a general principle, when, if ever, should aggregation of damages be permitted?
I think you can have aggregation of damages on a class-wide basis when all of the class members share in the same damages. So that, for example, if you have, let's take the donning and doffing case, Tyson Foods, although that was only on the liability side, the fact of the matter is that if a liability verdict comes in, you ought to be able to use the time records to say, well, based on the expert testimony, because we didn't have time records of the donning and doffing periods, but based upon some expert testimony, we know that each person had to spend 20 minutes before the start of shift putting their equipment on, 20 minutes after the end of shift taking their equipment off. If you can say that, you can then say to somebody, here's the formula for purposes of damages, because we know that you're all union members, you're making X number of dollars per hour, so we can work that all out.
Well, we know this is a warranty, breach of warranty case again. And I don't think we need to state a principle for all time as to what damages are aggregated. So, but I think we have in here is a cause of action, reliability verdict for breach of warranty, two kinds of warranty, three kinds of warranty.
But what I was trying to do was to answer
to show
the question
the aggregation,
from the general, then bring it down to the specific.
Right, okay.
Bringing that general proposition down to the specific, now, here we have, as you've said, it's a breach of warranty case. So you have to show that the warranty was breached, that I was entitled to get paid for a repair that I ended up having to pay for myself when you should have covered it under the warranty.
So their argument is, under the implied warranty, because the express warranty is only 36 months, it is that this no-cure brake pad problem went beyond the 36,000 miles, and that's where they started accumulating their damages.
And that's diminution of value, just by a different name.
So that's why I asked you at the beginning, was that 750 the alter ego, diminution of damage? You said no.
Well, honestly, because I don't know what that 750 was. Because if you listen to the testimony of Mr. King, he said 1250 per claimant. The jury came up with 750. Now, I can break it down. I can say, well, what Mr. King testified to was $250 per repair, five repairs over the period, that's $1,250, and the jury just decided that they were going to do some rough justice, and they said, okay, instead of five, we'll do three. At $250, it's $700. Now, what's the logic of that? I don't know. What I can tell you is that this exact case was tried in Pennsylvania. Same witnesses, same lawyers. The only difference was that the plaintiff in that case was a fellow named Samuel Bassett. It's the only difference. And it got tried in Philadelphia as opposed to Elizabeth. And that jury said $600. Now, where they came out with $600, who the devil knows?
But that's what juries do.
Well, they do that, but
there's no scientific... From one jury to another jury, you know there's no scientific precision to damages.
Well, except that in a breach of contract case, when you're talking about a breach of warranty, there should be. Especially when here, we did not contest, for all post-trial purposes, the $250 per repair
but,
amount.
One jury, as opposed to another, can credit the expert differently.
Well,
they didn't agree with the $1,250. Okay, so the New Jersey jury $750. I'm assuming the same expert said $1,250 in Philadelphia, and they came up with what, $600?
$600.
That's not unusual for a jury.
It isn't, but it points out the vagaries of trying to put any kind of logical reasoning behind the $750 number, and we know that you can't really even rely on it because it is based on an expert report that is a net opinion.
Well, the expert, tell me if I'm wrong about this, the expert was, for lack of data, other data, which happens, was relying on warranty data. And your argument, among others, is that warranty data is, first, it's repairs that were provided under warranty, and secondly, that doesn't extrapolate to the other people out there who never brought their cars in because they didn't bring their cars in.
Because
they didn't need to, or for whatever other reason. So you objected to the methodology. Did you, I assume you objected to the expert's methodology.
Absolutely.
At trial. Where's the final resolution of that issue? I mean, obviously, the expert was allowed to testify. Where did that go on appeal?
Well... We raised it at the appellate division. The appellate division just accepted his testimony without even discussing its admissibility, one of the many shortcomings in the appellate division's decision. They basically said, well, he testified to this. We give him credence, and therefore it is fine, without ever looking at the fact that he admits he made it up. It's just that simple. He just made it up. Because, as we all know, an expert under those circumstances is defined by what the representative plaintiff brings to the table. Here, the representative plaintiff was actually discarded by the expert. He said, she doesn't fit my model. So I'm not taking her into account at all. I'm saying that based upon my review, hypothetical plaintiff, this is what would have happened.
Now going back to Samuel Bassett for a second, you're arguing that the appellate division in discussing Samuel Bassett as if it were a ruling on the viability of aggregate damages, skip the part where they said they weren't ruling on that issue.
Well, they specifically said they weren't ruling on it, that what they said was, we're going to say there was a waiver. Well, that caused Justice Saylor, now Chief Justice Saylor, to write a pretty stringent dissent that said, what are you guys smoking?
The Pennsylvania case really doesn't help us here. If they came back with $750, that wouldn't alter your argument.
No, it wouldn't. Because it has the same, that case has the same shortcomings this case has, except that in this case, the plaintiff has been unable to argue waiver. In that case, they argued waiver. I don't know what the basis for it was.
I'm not sure that case helps.
Lord save us all in respect of it. But in this case, it is painfully clear that it was objected to over and over and over again. And yet here we are, that he was allowed to testify. And what is most telling is that the judge who tried the case 6 months later said, I made a mistake. I should never have allowed this to go to the jury on a class basis for damages. That should never have happened. And once she made that decision was entitled to the deference of an abuse of discretion standard. And if you read the appellate division decision, the appellate division applies the Manalapan Realty standard, which is, they said, it's a conclusion of law to which we owe no deference. Well, that's wrong. Because this court, as recently as the Dugan versus TGIA Fridays case 2 years ago, said decisions about certification and decertification are entitled to the abuse of discretion standard. Now, why the appellate division said that, I don't know, but...
Well, it gets a little tricky because she's also claiming she mischarged the jury, and a charge to the jury is typically an issue of law, no?
Yes, but the fact of the matter is the appellate division never even mentions the words abuse of discretion. You can look through the entire opinion, and those words do not appear. So we know that they missed the boat on that. Now, what I thought the court was asking us for in the order on certification was to provide you with an alternate method by which this court can then instruct others to go forward in circumstances like this. And with a fair amount of pride of ownership, I would say to the court, this case is an exact primer on how this should go about. Because in this case, the class was about 8,400 people. Counsel from both sides sat down and worked out a claim form. They agreed on it. That claim form was mailed to all 8,400 people. About 1,200 of them were returned. It's a question as to whether it was 1,200 or 1,199. One appeared to have been submitted twice, but be that as it may. So we have a claim form that the court can see at Supplemental Appendix 1. And that the one that we picked was, in fact, the one that was filed by the plaintiff, by her counsel. And the only sentence that is highlighted on that claim form, the only sentence that's in bold, is the one that says, important, you should submit your claim even if you cannot provide the documentation requested. And underneath, are you providing documentation with this claim form? A box for yes, a box for no. And on the plaintiff's form, it said no. Yet her claim was still adjudicated. Now, What happened was we now have 1,200 of these claim forms. We can't go to a special master and say, here's several boxes of claim forms, blow your brains out, try to figure them out. So what we did was that we sat down with plaintiff's counsel, and we said, there's got to be a better methodology for this. So we divided the claims forms into 9 categories and said, this one category, Kia accepts those should be paid for. There were 78 claims in that category. The other categories, we've got disputes in respect of that. Let's submit the categories to the special master, brief it, let the special master decide, and then we'll go from there. The special master did that and determined that, in fact, of these 8 remaining categories, 2 were, in fact, possibly compensatory. And they contained a total of 93 claims. So remember, we conceded on 78. And those 78 totaled somewhere around $40,000. The 93 that were disputed, we then said to the special master, okay, these you now have to adjudicate. And he determined that 22 of them would be denied outright, 33 of them would be partially awarded, and 38 of them would be fully awarded. The total amount of the disputed claims that were awarded was almost $25,000. So when you add it all together, between the ones that we accepted and the ones that the special master adjudicated, you had a total of $46,179. Why is that important? That's important because if you take the jury's verdict of $750 per claimant and you multiply it by 8,400, that number is over $6 million. So when the appellate division says, oh, it's a small windfall that's being provided, well, it's all a question of whose ox is getting gored, because it may be a small windfall to each individual plaintiff.
Let me ask you hypothetically, because I know where you're, I'm not going to ask as to the facts of your case, because I know what the response is going to be. Hypothetically, if you had proper expert methodology on diminution of value on a breach of warranty, express and implied minus and loss warranties theory, that was, you had admissible testimony that was accepted by the jury, excuse me, as to the difference in value between what was bought in a model year Kia and what was received based on this brake problem, could there be aggregate damages in a breach of warranty claim in those circumstances?
If the jury said that there was diminution of value?
Yes.
And each car was $1,000 less than what they should have been?
Right.
Yes.
That's aggregate.
That's
so you're not arguing against all aggregate damages in a class action?
In a class setting where you don't have diminution of value, you can't aggregate because now you're limited to just out-of-pocket expenses.
Yeah, but you're not arguing that that should not have gone to the jury. You're fine with diminution of...
It went to the jury.
Right.
I can't undo that. But what I can do is say, now that it's gone to the jury, let's respect what the jury did. And by the way, in Samuel Bassett, they also had a diminution of value claim, and that jury also said zero.
But you would have been fine with diminution of value going alone to the jury, because you conceded that that at least could have been determined on a class-wide basis, correct?
Not based on the evidence that had been presented, no.
Okay.
Not on the evidence that had been presented, because there is no way that Mr. King's testimony could be fixed.
No, forget
because the moment he separated himself
from the
plaintiff.
No, there was the other, Johnson, I forget the name of the other expert.
Strombaugh.
Okay, he testified to diminution of value, correct?
Strombaugh was our expert.
No, there was, didn't plaintiff have 2 experts, one on out-of-pocket damages and the other one on diminution? Or am I mistaken about
that?
That
was Matthews, wasn't it?
Matthews, yeah.
I'm not certain, Justice Alvin.
That was Matthews.
But I thought that the lion's share of the testimony that was being presented on diminution was by Mr. King.
But he had a theory of $2,000 a vehicle.
That was Matthews.
That was Matthews. He had a formula.
Clearly he wasn't very credible, so not so sure we should spend much time with him.
Are there other questions? Is there anything you'd like to add? I know we're not going to be able to cover each of the items you laid out.
I understand, but let me finish up with the notion of really why we are here, which I thought was the court asking us to give you a framework to work with. So we start out with a properly presented claims form that is handled by a claims administrator who makes sure that it goes to every person who's a putative member of the class. You have those come back. They should be evaluated. Counsel should work cooperatively in trying to determine which claims should be honored, which claims are disputed. A good special master should be selected to go through those and make those determinations in a way that is transparent and clear, and it couldn't have been more transparent than it was here. Everything was done open and above board. The sessions before the special magistrate were on the record. The special master issued not one but two separate reports, and he issued two separate reports because when he issued his first report, we said to him, we disagree with what you've determined in respect of three items. He issued a second report that said, you know what, you're right as to one of those. Not as to the O2, but as to one of those.
I'm not suggesting that anybody's responsible for the incredible amount of time this took, but shouldn't this be done in the discovery period and not 18 years after? You know, obviously there's a lot of leeway in a class for the trial judge to run things.
Your Honor, this case was pre-trial, was pending for 7 years.
I know, that's what I mean.
I can't speak to what happened in those seven years.
And I'm not talking about what happened here, because whatever happened, happened in this case. But you might have had a lot more people submitting claims if this had been done in 2005 instead of 2012 or whenever it was done.
No, actually it was done 2008.
Eight. Okay, but
putting that to the side, what we can be equally informed on is that this case does not exist in a vacuum. We talked about Samuel Bessett, what happened in that case. But there were two other cases involving this same claim. One of them was in Florida, the Butler case. And we've outlined it to the court. There, the trial judge certified the class, but an interlocutory appeal was taken. And the Intermediate Appeals Court in Florida said, you can't certify this class. There's no way. Common issues do not predominate. You can't do that.
So, Mr. Rivera-Soto, bottom line, what are you asking us to do?
I'm asking you to vacate the decision of the Appellate Division and to reinstate the judgment that was entered by Judge Crispin.
And not require any further proceedings at this point.
No further proceedings. That's what we did.
I'll have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Donovan, I'm going to apologize to people. I'm going to leave early, and I will not distort your arguments. I'll watch the rest of them on the video.
Thanks for the forewarning, Your Honor.
I trust that at some point you'll address the question, and I don't want to preempt your prepared remarks, as to whether and why it's appropriate to presume damages for all members of the class. But you'll get to that when you choose to. Go ahead.
I will, Your Honor. May it please the Court, as Your Honors know, my name is Michael Donovan, and together with co-counsel, I represent the respondent, plaintiff Regina Little, and the certified class. Your Honors, this Court's certification order granted review limited to the issue of damages. And I'll focus on that issue. I'm first going to cover what I believe this court should clearly hold. I'll then explain why I think the court should clearly hold that. And then I'll explain why I believe defendants' points and factual statements, many of them, are mistaken. First, respondent and the certified class request that this court hold clearly and unequivocally that damages for breach of warranty may be measured by the reasonably estimated cost to cure the breach, to bring the defective product into a non-defective condition, if that's in fact what the warrantor promised, as the warrantor here did promise that. This court should so hold that whether the case is an individual case or a class action. Let me tell you why the court should hold that. First, defendant concedes on page 42 of its supplemental brief, and I'll quote, if the fact of damages has been established but there is a lack of exact documentation, the amount of damages to be awarded to an injured plaintiff may be estimated if necessary. Defendant concedes that one can estimate reasonable costs to cure damages. Next, it is an ancient common law principle, as we discuss in the brief, that the amount of damages may be based on, quote, just and reasonable inference. This is a principle of substantive law. It is a principle so old that it predates the Republic. We discussed the multiple U.S. Supreme Court cases, all of which adopt the just and reasonable inference standard for the estimation of damages throughout different cases, antitrust, securities, breach of contract, multiple cases, all of which apply that principle. Third, the procedural class status of a case cannot and ought not alter, abridge, or enlarge the substantive law. To interpret the class action rules to alter, abridge, or affect the substantive laws would be elevating procedure over law. If the reasonably estimated cost to cure a breach, in other words, to bring a product into a non-defective condition, is calculated based on a reliable methodology that is properly admitted in evidence and considered by a jury, that reasonably estimated cost to cure will provide the just and reasonable inference for the award of damages to all members of that class. And if, as here, the jury instructions correctly tell the jury that they may consider the admitted evidence in quantifying the reasonably estimated cost to cure the defect and awarding class member damages, and this is important, Your Honors, the jury's decision on that evidence is entitled to substantial deference absent a manifest injustice.
Okay. But with everything that you've said, let's be precise. This is not a product defect case. This is a warranty case.
It is.
And the first sentence you started with assumed that the fact of damages has been established.
It has, Your Honor.
Well, where is that? Outside of someone having their express warranty honored by a dealership or Kia between the two of them?
I'm glad you asked that. And as we explained in the respondent's brief in the appellate division, and this is where I think my colleague has gone wrong, this warranty is not the typical American manufacturer warranty. This warranty promised a car, quote, free from defects in materials and workmanship. It promised at the delivery that the car would be, quote, unquote, free from defects in material and workmanship. Other American manufacturers don't use that anymore. They say, we will repair and replace anything that proves to be defective. There are two different types of conceptions.
I understand the difference, but, I mean, we are talking about brakes and brakes wear, and that's part of the argument that's percolating throughout this. The question is, are they wearing too frequently, and where's the proof of that for the individual claimant?
The proof of that was uniform throughout, and the jury considered it. The proof of that was in defendants' corporate own admissions. They admitted that, in fact, the brake system on this car was defective. There was testimony presented to the jury by the engineer from Korea who testified that it would be difficult from an engineering perspective to increase brake longevity because the rotors on this car and the brake pads could not dissipate heat.
Did they concede that to every owner of every Kia? Did they concede that every single Kia?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. what was defective?
They conceded that the car was designed the same for all models.
I understand, but there's a distinction there, and I think what we're hearing is that when it came down to the individual experience of car owners, that varied. Some people absolutely got a car that they had to rush right in and repair the brakes after 10,000 miles. Others, I guess, didn't notice the difference.
There's a couple of responses to that one, Your Honor. First, whether people have the money to get their brakes repaired so frequently or not is not really the relevant point here. Second, people are free to use a defective product in a defective condition. Third, the perspective, and this, I believe, is important because it gets conflated.
Counsel, wasn't there testimony from your expert that as to the named plaintiff, her car went 45,000 miles without any repairs to his knowledge?
No.
Or any required repairs?
That's not correct, Your Honor. What he said was that the repairs that were made before the 45,000 miles were covered by Kia. She had three brake repairs within, or four brake repairs, that were actually covered by Kia's warranty repair system up to 45,000 miles. The problem was that the brakes kept wearing out at 10,000 miles. So the sleight of hand, the way defendant portrays it in the brief, is that they asked the expert that this didn't apply to your client. Well, it didn't apply because her brakes were replaced free of charge by Kia three times before she got to 45,000 miles. It still wasn't fixed. And that's why there's an important difference between the warranty here. The repair and replace remedy in this case describes how Kia will meet its promise. It doesn't limit the promise. The promise itself is a car free from defects.
So why did you pursue a theory of out-of-pocket damages? I understand you were focused on diminution. You had an expert. That got rejected. But the out-of-pocket damages for repair takes into account that the remedy is limited to what was spent to do these periodic repairs during the period of ownership.
We didn't pursue a theory of out-of-pocket damages, Your Honor. What we pursued was a theory of cost, what would be the reasonably estimated cost to cure the defect in this car. And the reason we did that, let me just explain, it wasn't out-of-pocket damages. What the verdict sheet asked was state the damages reasonably incurred. That is what is set up in the UCC itself, that very principle. It's set forth in Section 214 of Article 2.
But your expert's theory was repair and repair and repair and repair, right?
Correct.
So that is what the expert was pursuing. So when you say the cost to cure the repair, you weren't saying that the brake system can be redesigned or replaced entirely or anything along these lines. You were your theory, as I understand it, through the mouth of your expert was this thing is junk, and the only thing that an owner can do is repair it and repair it and repair it and do so every 10,000 miles. So why isn't that a cost to repair theory?
What the expert was saying was that Kia was unable to restore this car to a non-defective condition because the rotors were too small, the wheel was too small, and the axle was mispositioned. He wasn't saying that every person would have to do this five times, extra normal repairs. What he was saying was that in order to provide a car that met the promise, and that is free from defects in material and workmanship, the only practical way to do that was to provide money for repairs over the useful life of that car.
So that was the theory.
That was the theory. And the perspective that you look at this is different. It's not from the buyer's perspective, Your Honor. It's from the market's perspective. If a manufacturer cannot restore the car to a non-defective condition, its warranty, its promise to do that, the repair and replace promise, has failed of its essential purpose. Again, that's set forth in the UCC 217.
I know you're stating that, but that's not what's... I'm looking at the verdict sheet. That's sounding closer to diminution of value.
Yes.
I mean, the question submitted to the jury was the amount of damage sustained by each class member for repair expenses reasonably incurred as a result of defendant's breach of a warranty. And the question that your adversary is raising is that you're not able to come up with a representative number that is going to reflect the cost to each class member. He's saying it's not possible, so that some people are going to get an incredible windfall. Maybe some class members will get something way below what they should be getting. And that the only way to do this is based upon the system that was used by using claim forms. That's what he's arguing. Why isn't that reasonable?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, the verdict sheet follows the law that is set forth in 2714 of the UCC. It states that the goal of an award of damages is to return the buyer to the position he or she would have been in had the warranty been complied with. Here, because you could never return the car to a non-defective condition, the question is, what reasonable amount would be required for the buyers of this car to be restored with a non-defective car?
That's not what the but that's not the question. The question says repair expenses. What you're stating sounds like a very easy equation for diminution of damages, but the verdict sheet on which the jury returned damages was for the amount of repair expenses that were incurred by the class members.
Reasonably incurred, Your Honor, and
right.
That is
right.
The language.
Reasonably incurred.
That is the language that's set forth in 2714.
UCC, and that's your expert presented a theory of what it costs for these owners on average to do repairs.
That's exactly not what it costs the owners on average. What the market would set forth for the cost to cure the defect in this case.
So how is that different from diminution of value?
It's different in a lot of ways. Diminution of value is what the difference in market price between the value of the car is when you bought it and the value of the car that you received. The way most diminution in value calculations are done is they're done through a regression analysis. And that is, but the problem, and this court's recognized that type of measure is difficult. The regression analysis tries to isolate, okay, what is the depreciation that's attributable to the brake defect here? Well, it's hard to isolate that because there may be other.
You did have an expert on that.
We did have an expert. It was Mr.
Matthews.
It was Professor Matthews.
And that was admitted.
And that was admitted. And but there's other ways under the UCC to measure that type of benefit.
So explain to us how the jury could have come, given its calculation on number six, okay, repair damage, 750, that's 250 times three. How the jury could have come up with that and a zero on diminution of value. Can you logically explain that to us?
I can. The goal of the measure of damages is to restore the buyers to the position they would have been in had the warrantor provided a product free from defects. And that's how the jury was instructed. One way to measure that is in diminution in value. The other way to measure that is the cost incurred throughout the useful life of this product in order to bring it into compliance.
Were these duplicative theories? Were they really going after the same damages?
Yes. They're two sides of a double-sided ruler, Your Honor. That's exactly what it is.
So if they had awarded $10 million on each and your adversary came in and said, wait a minute, this is duplicating it, well, would you have said, yeah, let's cut it in half?
Well, no, because it's conceivable that you could, in fact, have to incur multiple repairs while you own the car, but also have a car of diminished value. In other words, when you go and sell that car, it's even diminished more. That it's conceivable that you can have two. They're complementary measures, two sides of a double-sided ruler. For example, you buy a product, you can't ever fix it. You use it, but the whole world knows that this product has to have a lot of repairs. Well, it's going to lose value too. But you also are going to keep it in a non-defective condition, incur costs. And that's how the court instructed the jury. And the jury, looked at these double-sided rulers, and it determined that, okay, well, we're not so sure about the diminution because we're not
sure. They were sure. It was a no cause.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I think that the measure here is, as in the Samuel Bassett case, and this is why I think Samuel Bassett is worthwhile considering. What happened in Samuel Bassett is we tried that in 05. The difference was that the cost of a brake repair increased by $50 in the interim between when the trial in this case was 08. The party stipulated in 05 that each brake repair was $200.
So you think it's the same verdict?
It's identical. And what are the chances of that when two different juries, two different judges, two different locales, same facts, same evidence, same experts, same lawyers on both sides come to the exact same verdict? The chances are remote, but they're scientific, Your Honor, at least in this respect, because it is a fair calculation. I would submit, Your Honors, given that you could, defendant can't show a manifest injustice, which I believe is the burden it has to show in order to displace this jury verdict.
Assume that question number six should not have gone to the jury, as the trial judge concluded, and that the repair damages were only susceptible on an individual claim form. Do you have an argument that you were prejudiced on number five? Are you following me? That you didn't therefore get a fair, you could not have gotten a fair trial on diminution of damages. Are you following me?
I am. I guess there would be an argument because I do think they are two related measure. There are two related measures of damages. The measure of damages under the UCC is the amount necessary to return the buyer to the position he or she would have been in had the warrantor fully performed. That's the instruction. How that's measured can be varied.
And so it is the same. We're back to where we were a few minutes ago.
Well, the goal...
Was it two different ways to get at the same pot of money, or
yeah,
was it...
They are two different measures of the benefit of the bargain.
But then you also told us they were entirely separate.
I don't think we did. What we said was they're complementary, Your Honor, that you could award both, you can award one, not the other, and you can award none. They are both...
And they awarded one and not the other.
Correct.
So, going back to Justice Albin's question, if that other, number six, should not have gone to the jury, how are you hurt?
Well, because they are the benefit of the bargain. We would be hurt because putting one to the jury without the other is not measuring the benefit of the bargain lost properly. In other words, you're not asking the jury to decide the benefit of the bargain. You're asking the jury to decide one component of the bargain, and that is, oh, did you get something less than what you paid?
Your argument is, I think, boiled down to its essence, that the jury may have felt that you were getting full compensation on number six, and that ended the story.
I think
but
that's
now
right.
If number six shouldn't have been on the verdict form, then you have a different problem.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But I think number six should have been on the verdict form, and let me turn to why I think that. First, this court decided in First v. Einstein Mungi and Cox v. Sears Roebuck that, in fact, the rule of reasonably estimated damages was, in fact, a proper award for...
So it is, and so... Look, I wrote Einstein.
Right.
It's a single...
Did you just say it was Einstein?
Huh?
No, close.
Said he went to school with Einstein.
Oops. Yeah. I did.
I believe you, Your Honor.
Yeah, so, look, that case, and many of the other cases that you've cited from time immemorial, we're dealing with single plaintiffs, right. You know, estimating damages that are just and reasonable inferences. The U.S. Supreme Court cases that you're citing from the 19th century are not class action cases, no? Or were they class
many
action
are.
Cases?
Many are. They're antitrust cases, Your Honor. Okay. So they would be class cases, yes.
It seems to me it's a different kettle of fish than you're dealing with one as opposed to 8,600, no?
I don't think it is, and nor do I think this court should do that. I think that would be error because I don't think you can have a rule of law that is different for class actions that a rule of law
not,
for individuals.
But you never would have.
No.
Muse gets at this, maybe using different words. It just says when the glue that, to use a word that your adversaries used, falls apart on a theory of a claim, then it no longer works to keep the class together for purposes of aggrandizing damages.
I understand that point, Your Honors, and I think that the difference is the difference between contract and tort. I mean, in Muse, what you have is you have spoiled goods and things of that nature.
Right.
You also don't have a breach of contract there anymore because they weren't provided with power. So that contract claim was dismissed on summary judgment. What you the difference between contract and tort is that you have to experience the damage first in tort. In contract, the question is whether you broke the promise. It doesn't matter whether you expended individually or not. In Cox, this court said, well, wait a second, you don't have to fix the kitchen in order to recover. You can get the reasonably estimated cost to return that kitchen to a non-defective condition.
Well, that's a consumer fraud case. That's a statutory cause of action.
Well, I understand. It's still measured by...
We're talking about breach of warranty. I mean, and you know, you've cited all kinds of different cases, but we're talking about breach of warranty. It's a very precise cause of action.
Your Honor, Cox deals with the exact measure of the breach of warranty in that case, and in fact says we will use as the measure the benefit of the bargain amount, and it uses the contract measure. The fact that the cause of action was that doesn't mean that it doesn't equally apply to the UCC measure of damages, and it uses benefit of the bargain. And that's all we have here. Let me give you an example of why this court should hold that, because all of the other courts have also held that. We submitted to the court the Nian v. Nissan Motors acceptance case from the Ninth Circuit. That court also held in a class action, there you have a defective clutch system, that measuring damages by the reasonably estimated costs to cure in a similar it is appropriate in a car warranty class action. We submitted that in July.
We're here 20 years later, almost 20 years later.
Yeah.
You've got a proposal from your adversary as to a way to come to a conclusion with this, and that is claim forms evaluated, counsel working cooperatively under the rubric of a special master. What's wrong with that proposal?
One, it doesn't award our client any damages. We went through that, and the special master misconstrued the warranty here. Our client incurred her damages after 45,000 miles. She went out of pocket $245 after 36,000 miles expired. She never got a car that was free from a defective brake system. In fact, it was repaired by defendant three, four times before the 36,000 miles, still broken, and then she had to pay again for the same defective brakes. They kept putting the same defective parts on the car.
The thing that confuses me about your theory is, from listening to your argument today, you'd think that the cause of action and the expert testimony would all have been aimed toward give us another Kia without with the reconstituted brakes. That's what your argument is talking about.
We wish we could have done that. In 08, Your Honor, it was too late.
Okay. But the case was it tried with the remedy being give us back the money, we are out for repairs. That's
no,
what
it was give us back the amount that would be reasonably necessary to compensate us for getting the car back to a non-defective condition. It was reasonably incurred, the amount reasonably incurred to get the car to a non-defective condition. That amount, the expert calculated.
Was it just the way you have stated that proposition? Was the jury charged just in that fashion, just the way you've stated it to us?
The jury was charged that you were to award the benefit of the bargain damages and that the decision on the benefit of the bargain damages is up to you, how you award it. That's how the jury was charged. In terms of the claim, the verdict sheet was given to the jury, but apart from the benefit of the bargain instruction about damages, nothing more was given.
Was the verdict sheet objected to during the pretrial charge conference or at the charge conference?
The verdict sheet was objected to, and defendant had contended that One of the questions, but not both, should go to the jury, either or, but not both.
But
and the judge ruled
from,
that both should go to the jury.
Was there any objection from your side?
No.
I have the charge in front of me. So I'm looking at PA 51, which has the diminution of damages. I won't quote that. But the second part is, damages may also be measured by the increased cost of maintenance and repair to purchasers and lessees of the Sophia as a result of the defects. Right. So that was the language they were charged on.
Right, increased cost of maintenance.
Okay.
That's correct.
So I'm looking at that language, and I'm looking at what you're saying the damages formula is or should be, and I'm asking, was that charged to the jury?
Yes.
But where? Tell me.
That's
not what you said, though. That's different. Damages may also be measured by the increased cost of maintenance and repair.
Well,
that's not returning to a non-defective condition.
Well, I think it is in this context, Your Honor, because here the brakes could not be restored. You couldn't cure the brakes here. The brakes were defective always. In order to get brakes that would last another 10,000 miles, you would have to pay for that again. So that would be increased cost of maintenance. And what the model was that was provided to the jury was that you're replacing brakes every 10,000 when a non-defective car would be 20,000. That meant you would have 5 extra normal repairs if you assume 100,000 miles
so,
of life.
Look, it seems to me that if that's the language you want, I should have asked that to be charged with, because that sounds very much like diminution of damages. Measure of damages, difference in value between the vehicle is promised minus the value of vehicle as delivered in defective condition.
And the
statement that you've been making sounds much closer to diminution of value than it does to this reasonable cost of repairs. You following me?
I think the point of breach of contract damages is to award the benefit of the bargain.
And you gave the jury, and I'm not faulting you at all, I'm sure it was very well tried, you gave the jury 2 alternative measures to get to a significant amount of dollars.
Not alternative necessarily,
right.
2 complementary.
All right, complementary,
right.
Call them what you will. They rejected the one that was much more susceptible to aggregate proofs. And the one you were left with is the one that the trial court decided after the jury verdict came in should have been subject to individualized proof. And I think that's the problem you're facing here is that there wouldn't even be an issue if the jury had awarded damages on the other theory with respect to the aggregated proofs.
Well, Your Honor, let me put it this way. There are 2 types of class actions. There's a replicated proof class action, and then there's an aggregated proof class action. An aggregated proof class action would be your securities case. The market is inflated as a result of the purchases. It's inflated by X amount.
For all
the
market.
People who purchased, they right. share in an aggregate amount. A replicated proof class action is more similar to an antitrust sort of case or more similar to just a breach of contract or consumer case. And that is, if an individual putting on an individual case would of necessity prove the same claims for all other people in that class, then that's replicated proof. And here,
I think you've hit the essence of what the issue
right.
is.
And here, if 8,400 people tried this case in individuals before 8,400 juries, they would come in with Mr. King's expert testimony. They would, because on an individual case...
You wouldn't need expert testimony. If you had 8,400 trials, the necessity of expert testimony here is due to the aggregation.
That's not true, Your Honor. That is not true.
If you had individual people walking into court, into small claims court, to try their cases... Why would you even have an expert? That individual would say, I had 5 repairs, I had 3 repairs, I had 6. And the court would award what damages it considered appropriate.
There are another number of responses to that. First, For individuals, the absence of receipts in an individual case wouldn't bar recovery. Second, to the extent an individual came in and said, well, look, I've had this one repair after 36,000 miles that I had to pay out of pocket of, but I'm still going to have this car, and it's still defective. They can't fix it. I would need an expert to say, okay, what are the reasonably estimated expenses that you would incur going forward? That would happen in 8,400 cases. That's what happened in Cox v. Sears Roebuck. That's the identical thing. And people could come in and say, what? Defendant would come in to some of them and say, well, wait a second. You didn't pay for a brake repair at 70,000 miles. And the person might come in and says, yeah, I didn't have any money because I had to pay tuition.
Okay, so of the 8,600 people in your class, do we know the average period that they actually owned the car? Do we know?
We do not know.
So some of these people may have owned it for 1 year, some for 3 years, all covered by the warranty?
Correct.
No out-of-pocket expenses? So let's say, and I'm just using some hypothetical because you don't know the number, that 4,000 people in that class wound up selling their Kia, no out-of-pocket expenses. They're part of this 8,600 class and getting this $750 windfall? Why?
Because they all received a defective car that could not be restored to a non-defective condition. There is no dispute, and that's what the jury found. There's no dispute that Kia could never fix this car. If it were a different case, Your Honor, I would agree with you.
But that's not, so I'm going back to number six, and I know I'm repeating myself. It says the repair expenses sustained by each class member. And you're telling me even if 4,000, half of the class had no repair expenses, that's okay.
No, the question is asking the expenses reasonably incurred. When people bought this car, they bought a car that would cost according to the jury's evaluation, they bought a car that would cost $750 more dollars for them to own to restore it to a non-defective condition.
I know I'm repeating myself. I'm not going to do it again. That sounds like... It really sounds just a replay of diminution of value.
But it's not, Your Honor. It isn't, and I don't know what
to... How can it not be if they didn't incur the repair? How can it be anything but diminution if the people that are entitled never incurred a repair, never incurred an expense? How can it not be diminution?
The homeowner in Cox didn't incur the cost to replace the kitchen. They didn't incur that cost. Yet they were awarded that cost to repair the condition, that because the defendant promised them a defect-free condition. And this court awarded them the reasonably estimated costs. The fact that someone chooses to use a car in a defective condition doesn't mean that they're not entitled to get the reasonable cost to restore the car to a non-defective condition. If the defendant promised, as here, a car free from defects in material and workmanship.
Mr. Donovan, I just want to ask if you could try to sum up any remaining points that you have. I think we understand this argument that you're making.
I will, Your Honor. Okay. My very point was addressed by the Ninth Circuit in the Nissan Motors case, which is a class action. My very point was also addressed by the Eleventh Circuit in the Cariarulo v. General Motors case. Again, there the court said, and this is the principle that we think the court should adopt, the benefit of the bargain model provides a standardized class-wide damages figure. Because the plaintiff's out-of-pocket payment is irrelevant, is immaterial, that's in the 11th Circuit decision. And in countless decisions, GM trucks, even the Cox v. Sears Roebuck decision, courts have said that for a replicated proof class action like this, that amount necessary to restore the buyer to the position she would have been in had the defendant complied with the warranty may be awarded and may be awarded to all members of the class if the warranty breach is identical and all of the other factors are identical as they were here. I think Samuel Bassett holds the same. And let me end on this. This is why Tyson Foods is relevant. The Supreme Court of the United States said that estimates of class damages as here, may be used to calculate damages when the defendant cannot or does not provide records for more precise calculations. Now, defendant says, well, that's a liability determination and everything. Well, if liability has to be determined with more certitude than the just...
It's not liable. It's just not a good... I don't think Tyson's a very good comparison for you, because you had a class of people who are doffing and donning clothes. All of them are doing that. Some are doing it maybe in 20 minutes. Some are doing it in 15 minutes. And then an expert can... And all of them are doing it. We know that. And someone may come up with an estimate of 17 minutes. That's far from the case that we have here.
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you can reasonably estimate damages to establish liability, then you can reasonably estimate damages to award for a breach of contract. After all, you just need a just and reasonable inference. The fact that defendant didn't offer the dealer records to show exactly how many repairs were done at its dealers demonstrates that there was an absence of records that we could rely on the expert to extend out, well, what would be the reasonable amount. In fact, that's what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court itself held in the appeal here. So I don't think that we get tied into, well, we need an aggregate glue. If we had a different case that was an aggregation case, securities case, a tort case, that might apply. When you have a replicated proof class action where everybody has the same product that's defective in the same way, you use the same individual measure appropriately for all, because they all got the same breached product that couldn't be cured. If it could be cured, it'd be a different thing, Your Honor. Totally different. But it couldn't be cured here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
I know some of us have to leave to start atoning, some more than others. So... On that point, the difference in this case, I think, can be stated differently than we've had up until now. And that is the difference between common damages and idiosyncratic damages. And the common damages here are the diminution in value damages, and they're not in the case anymore. The out-of-pocket expenses, those are idiosyncratic damages. They belong to each individual plaintiff. And if you come to that conclusion, then you cannot certify this as a class, and you have to follow the claims proceeding that we have, well, that in fact was followed in this case, and that should have been the proceeding from the get-go. Now, Mr. Donovan quoted my brief, which was very nice of him, but he didn't quote the whole thing. Because immediately following the portion that he quoted is the following. That said, as discussed at length above, an estimate of damages may occur only after, and the after is underscored, it is determined that a particular plaintiff is entitled to any damages at all. That is, once a plaintiff claimant has established liability and the fact of damages and entitlement to damages cannot be estimated or based on speculation. That is the vice of this case.
Well, can I ask you this question?
Sure.
And this is, I think, the point the plaintiff's. Even he's saying that a class member was entitled to recompense, even if he didn't go or she didn't go for repairs, if they're riding around on their squeaky, defective brakes, they're still entitled to compensation, because that's not what they bargained for.
Well, what they bargained for was a warranty system of repair, and that's what Thiedemann tells us. And so if that individual plaintiff makes the decision that they'd rather ride around on squeaky brakes, that's the choice they've made, because under their contract, they have an option.
For $36,000, but not for $45,000.
Not for $45,000, not for $60,000 either. But that was their contract. That's what they agreed to. And what is extraordinary is we keep hearing about Mrs. Little, who's now has the married name of Pinks. But Mrs. Little, her claim form, and I invite the court to look at Supplemental Appendix 1, because there are seven claims listed there. The first one was at 7,400 miles. She claims she paid for the repairs. The next one is at 12,000 miles. She claims she paid for the repairs. 25,000 miles. She claims she paid for the repairs. 30,000 miles. She claims she paid for the repairs. Yet what the special master found was that she didn't pay for the repairs. Anything that was covered by her warranty was paid for by Kia, and therefore she had no claim. And question then, if she had no claim for damages, how could she possibly ever be a representative plaintiff in this action? And we filed a motion to decertify the class based on that finding. Now, what we keep hearing from the plaintiff is, I guess, the only argument the plaintiff can advance, which is trying to dress up out-of-pocket expenses as if they were a diminution in value, because that's the only way that they can try to keep the class together for damages. But they lost that. And not only did they lose it, they never appealed it. So it's not before this court. What's before this court is a jury verdict solely on the breach of warranty case. And in that case, solely on the damages. I'm sorry, the out-of-pocket expenses. And as to that, it is important that the court focus on the verdict form, because the verdict form tells us what this case is about. And as to question 5, it says, state the amount of damages sustained by each class member for the difference in value, if any, of the Cephea as warranted compared to the Cephea as delivered. Zero. That ship has sailed, and they did not appeal that verdict. The next question is, state the amount of damages sustained by each class member for repair expenses reasonably incurred as a result of defendant's breach of warranty. Well, as some people here have heard me say before, English is not my native language. But I think I know what the words reasonably incurred means. That means you actually spent the money. That means out of pocket. And that's the only issue before this court. How do we get to a proper and just resolution when you have a class of people who have differing amounts of what they reasonably incurred, and therefore it is not susceptible to class treatment?
Please remember, this is rebuttal.
I'm sorry. My apologies if I've gone too far. The important issue to remember from everything we've heard from plaintiff's counsel is that the existence of a defect is not a breach of warranty. Cars are complex instrumentalities, as Thiedemann tells us. Mm-hmm. The fact you have a defect is you got a defect. What happens after that is what's important. And in this state, we place a premium on robust warranty programs in order to try to put the consumer and the manufacturer on a more equal footing. That's exactly what happened here. And to try to come up with some scheme whereby a windfall is provided to people who never reasonably incurred one penny is contrary to our basic notions of justice and cannot be allowed here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both sides, for the fine arguments today. As the Chief indicated, he'll watch the argument and participate. Court is adjourned.